welcome this morning our guest speaker, Mr. Larry Stamer, from the religion editor of the Los Angeles Times, who's flown in just within the last hour, and we're just exceedingly happy that he was able to get here. Mr. Stamer is, as I said, the current religion writer for the Los Angeles Times from 1992 to the present. He was the environmental writer from 1985 to 1992. Before that, and the general assignment writer from 1982 to 85. Before that, Larry was with the Times Sacramento Bureau from 1975 to 82 and the San Jose Mercury News Sacramento Bureau from 1969 to 75. He also served as administrative assistant to a member of the California legislature. As correspondent in Sacramento, first for the San Jose Mercury and then for the Los Angeles Times, Larry covered the administrations of Governors Ronald Reagan and Jerry Brown. As a Times environmental reporter, Stamer has covered the Exxon Valdez oil spill, negotiations in London over the ozone treaty, known as the Montreal Protocol, preliminary meetings at the United Nations in New York in preparation for the Rio Earth Summit. As a religion writer, he has covered Pope John Paul II and traveled throughout the United States reporting and writing on various religion stories, including a trip to Nauvoo on the 150th anniversary of the Mormon Exodus, interviews with Presidents Howard W. Hunter and Gordon B. Hinckley, and discussions within the church regarding the curse of Cain. He has also covered the blessings of a same-gender union by a United Methodist minister and religious diversity in Los Angeles, where scholars report there to be more than 600 distinct religious expressions within the city. He is a contributor to a political science text written by George Hamilton of Columbia University and is currently writing a book for Island Press dealing with the intersection of religion and the environment. Mr. Stamer has served as president of the Sacramento chapter of Sigma Delta Chi, the Professional Journalistic Society. He and his wife, Sarah, live with their two grown daughters and their two grandchildren in, I understand that they at least live in Santa Monica. We have as our respondent, or at least comments, Eric Jones with us here, whom many of you may know as the managing editor of Sunstone, and I understand he is a great outdoorsman and devoted to it. This morning, you may not have caught this, but there was a tiny article in the Salt Lake Tribune saying that this weekend, this very weekend, our population on the planet should catch the 6 billion mark. And so I think it is quite appropriate that we are here this morning discussing this subject. Thank you. As you know, tapes are available in the book room of all sessions. We will have questions at the end of the comments.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's the first time I've had the privilege of speaking to Sunstone people and Sunstone Symposium. And I really appreciate the theme of this year's program, Faith Seeking Understanding. I think that's what we ought to all be doing at all times. I have to tell you that I speak with a little bit of trepidation because I was speaking just very recently with the dean of the Episcopal Theology talking, and she was telling me, she said, you know, the worst sermon I ever heard was given by a priest who gave his congregations home movies of his mind. And I was thinking to myself, well, that's what I was going to do. I'm going to give you a little home movie of my mind. And that's how I would like to begin. First, by telling you a little bit about what is dear to my heart, a place, a land of my heritage, and how then I connect changes on that piece of land to what's happening here in the United States and across the globe as environmental commons are threatened. by all kinds of things I know you've heard. Then we'll talk a little bit about our consumer culture, and finally, the religious imagination, and I hope to be able to tie this all together for you. So let me just begin by saying that there is a place of the heart to which I return whenever I can. It's a two-story log cabin nestled between some sugar maples on a bluff in rural Callaway County, Missouri, which is where my family is from. And I was telling Eric earlier, maybe I ought not to admit to that given the church's history and what happened to you. And I'm wondering, well, was my great-great-grandparent involved in some way? Well, the river moves along, doesn't it? But anyway, this place is called the Old Home Place. It's what my grandmother, Sadie Potts Clayton, called the Old Home Place. And for me, it's a milepost of the heart. It's an intersection of time and place where all that follows is measured by that which came before. It reminds me from whence I came and how far I have wandered, not only from the warmth of its hearth, but from the values and the way of life it's come to symbolize for me. Although I'm not a farmer, this land sustains me. I sit on the crest of that hill I was talking to you about, overlooking a meadow. I press my hand against the earth like a child pressing against a mother's breast. My back rests against the trunk of a tree, and I revel in the strength of its woody sinews. My thoughts are borne on the wings of a red-tailed hawk that traces lazy circles high in the sky. Behind me, the woods beckon with the promise of the undiscovered, an unexpected cave, a waterfall, an ancient oak. I listen and watch and wait for that certain insight that sometimes comes in these moments, that breath of sweet inspiration. These are the ethicas in our lives of which the poet Constantine Cavafy wrote in his retelling of Odysseus's heroic struggle to return to Ithaca in Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey. Like Odysseus, we learn that the value of our Ithacas is not so much in their place, and perhaps not even in our arriving, but in their power to inspire, to motivate, and to give meaning. Your Ithaca need not be a log cabin or even in a rural setting. Such insights could be born by the contemplation of a potted plant on a windowsill in a New York City apartment. It could be hiking in the mountains or a favorite jogging trail or walking along the beach. The point is that most of us from time to time need something in the natural world to stir our imaginations, to move us to reflect on the quality of our lives and to bring perspective to our comings and goings, and to connect us with something larger than ourselves. Entering the still woods to the north of the log cabin, entrusted for just a time to my care, is a celebration of the timelessness of creation. Here one can not only see, but actually experience the elegant design of nature, the fitting together of all things animate and inanimate, the muffled sound of snowflakes sliding on brittle leaves, cardinal singing, kind of a carol in a cedar tree, the muffled sound of icy water over limestone. Each has their own place, as do we, and all comprise a peon to the created universe in which we live and move and have our being. As I sat on a log overlooking Taylor's Brook, a small tributary named after my granddaughter, to Avaz Creek, and Avaz Creek courses through the county and ultimately empties into the Missouri River, there was a time to think and not to think, a time to empty oneself of self, and in so doing humbly enter into communion with the ground of all being, the immanent and transcendent, the whole, the creative force, the all-knowing God. At such a time, when time stops, the soul is freed from the bonds we place upon ourselves. In such moments, which for me are all too rare, we can become conscious of our connection with all of creation. Fashioned out of the dust of stars 13 billion years after the Big Bang, We celebrate our very being as self-aware manifestations of creation looking back upon itself. Each of us stand as unique personalities, and yet we do not stand alone. We are sisters and brothers to every other thing in the universe, living and non-living, because like them, we were fashioned out of the same cosmic womb, the fiery furnace of creation, ignited by the one reality which I am compelled to call God. Like them, we stand as part of the whole. Like them, our existence is contingent upon a force beyond our comprehension, which courses through the universe, unfolding in ever more complex and really wondrous ways. And these universal insights, expressed in diverse cultural and spiritual traditions, give meaning and a sense of peace and affirmation in what can otherwise be a very blurred existence. Yet as I sat on that fallen log, that chronicle of natural history whose tree rings marked good years and hard years since I was born, there was, I have to tell you, a palpable sense of discomfort that enjoined my reverie. I began thinking how our modern lifestyles are setting in motion unpredictable environmental consequences that could alter the very woods that offered me refuge and solace, insight, and joy. I wondered whether my grandchildren's children and their children would romp through these woods. Would they sit on a log, as I did, and tilt their head back like this and watch the snowflakes come down? Would they see deer tracks disappearing into the woods? In the next millennium, would these woods and meadows even be there for these kinds of discoveries and epiphanies? And would future generations delight in a meadowlark's song, be thrilled by wild turkeys on the wing? You know, when we bought that land, they said that there were wild turkeys on the land, and I thought, well, yeah, they know I'm from California, and I'll believe it when I see it, but there really are. It's just this fabulous place. I wondered also whether the land would be so stressed and the trees cut in the name of progress or economic necessity, and would climate change, sometimes called global warming, alter the regional biosphere? Would the oaks and the elms and the hickories, the cedar and the dogwoods remain? My trek into the wintry woods was a reminder not only of how far my pursuit of the good life has carried me from the truly good life, but that my modern lifestyle, the things I choose to buy, the energy I use to power them, even my choices of what I eat, were unintentionally contributing in a very real way to wounding the very thing that so delighted my senses and awakened my soul, this good earth, our island home, our Ithaca. As we enter the new millennium, our lives, our posterity, and the future of the earth are at a crossroads. The path we take will determine whether we will be at peace within ourselves and live harmoniously with our neighbors and our life-affirming planet, or remain estranged from the deepest longings of our souls and indifferent to the plundering of the planet on which all life depends. Never has our connection and our dependence upon the natural world for our physical well-being, as well as our spiritual healing, been more apparent. Sadly, never has the threat to the natural world and therefore our own well-being been greater. Where did we lose our way? Like a tenderfoot in the wilderness, we have made hundreds of small decisions that have led us off the path, a little turn there, a distraction there. But to continue this metaphor, we are here today less concerned with those small turns and distractions than we are with the fact that our moral compass is out of whack. Instead of pointing to true north, it's pointing to a magnetic north, and the lodestones that are turning that compass needle are our consumer culture and our misplaced drive for something deeper. I worry that these consumer choices and other decisions of good people like myself and you, hopefully myself, definitely you, I would have to say that, not to mention the decisions of multinational corporations bent on maximizing profit, sometimes at the expense of the natural world, are unleashing forces that are upsetting natural systems around the globe, not only the tropical rainforest of which we have heard so much, but perhaps the woods along Avaz Creek in Callaway County, Missouri. Even now, the bird songs and the sound of wind whistling through the sugar maples is joined by the discordant roar of 18-wheelers coursing east and west on Interstate 70, their big diesels belching diesel smoke and exhaust around the clock, trying to satisfy America's insatiable desire for more and more. We have all heard much about our consumer culture, our shop-till-we-drop mentality, our throwaway society. Yet, in the midst of plenty, one thing seems just beyond our grasp: authentic meaning and genuine happiness. We buy more and more, but there doesn't appear to be a commensurate improvement in the quality of our lives. In our reach for the American dream, too many of us have mortgaged not only our incomes, but our interior lives. We have become so bound up in the work and spend culture that we have forfeited authenticity for trinkets. Now, this may be a Los Angeles perspective. Maybe things are a little different here in Utah, so I'll apologize for that now. But at least in a big city, this represents the truth as many of us see it there. We are working longer just to keep up with the demands and the cost of the good life. We have less time for our loved ones because we are spending so much time trying to make ends meet. Our lives are measured in the silent blink of digital watches and shouted traffic reports on the car radio. And as the Reverend Gary Hall of All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, said one time, he said, quote, "Contrary to what we might think in our comfort, it is not the comfortable we would call happy," close quote. This should be of special concern to people of faith, because when it comes to consumerism, what the great faiths have called in the past materialism, there is little difference in the consuming habits of those who profess a faith and those who don't. This is strange indeed, because such lifestyles in the final analysis can be, if it's an exaggerated consumerism, can be, to use an old-fashioned word, both idolatrous. Idolatrous because it puts one's trust in something that is less than the whole, and blasphemous because it degrades something created by God. This forecloses our encounter with the holy. At a time when so many are engaged in a search for meaning and open to spiritual seeking, the predominant faith traditions, although rich in wisdom and insight into the human condition, have failed to make the connection in America between materialism and spiritual and environmental impoverishment. Strikingly, the most profound observations come at times not from the lips of leaders, theologians, and clergy, but from thoughtful scientists and academicians. Lynn White, a history professor at one time at California State University, said it well in a 1967 article that appeared in the journal Science. He wrote, What we do about ecology depends on our ideas of the man-nature relationship. More science and more technology are not going to get us out of the present ecologic crisis until we find a new religion or rethink our old one. The Union of Concerned Scientists, including 96 Nobel laureates, speaks of stewardship. Stewardship is normally a word you hear associated with churches. The Union of Concerned Scientists are talking about stewardship of the planet. They say that if we continue on the present course, it may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. A great change in our stewardship of the earth and the life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated, close quote. And then, of course, there's Arnold Toynbee, the British historian and philosopher. And he put it this way. He said, quote, "We are suffering from having sold our souls in the pursuit of maximizing material wealth, a pursuit which is spiritually wrong and practically unattainable. We have to recognize our objective and we have to change it," close quote. So at its heart, the crisis of the environment is a crisis of the spirit. The crisis of the environment is a crisis of the spirit. Until we look inwardly, each of us, and begin to rethink how we meet our legitimate needs and where we find our meaning, all the regulations in the world won't save the environment, and all the stuff in the world will not bring us happiness. And of course, we must provide the necessities of life, food, clothing, shelter for ourselves and for those we love. We provide for our education and that of our children. But now this is again an LA orientation, but how powerful a car do we need when we commute to work? What are our transportation alternatives? How many other things must we have? What is the difference between need and want? And what is at the root? What's behind this drive for the accumulation of more and more? So intertwined are the economy, the environment, and our spiritual health that Roman Catholic bishops have concluded, and I quote, that nothing but a wholehearted and ever more profound turning to the Maker of heaven and earth will allow us to carry out our responsibilities, close quote. To use the vocabulary of religion, without a transformation or a conversion, we may jump from one good cause to the next, environmentally speaking, and that in itself is wonderful. It's fine. It needs to happen. But I have a sense that, you know, it'll be a fad. We'll jump from one cause. Today it might be my daughter got involved in Save the Bay, saving Santa Monica Bay. Or it might be involved in saving the dolphins tomorrow or something else the next day. But without some overarching religious ethos that defines and informs the decisions that we make, there won't be as much staying power, I don't think. Thus, meeting the environmental crisis that we and succeeding generations, and this is the other point, I've grown more generational with grandchildren now, and I worry now about what's going to happen. What kind of world do they inherit? What kind of world do we leave them, and on down? Without a moral force, I worry. It was Mahatma Gandhi who said, quote, we must be the change we wish to see in the world. So the change begins with us. We can't be discouraged when we think of these global environmental problems. Climate change, what can I do about climate change? I mean, do I have to feel guilty about driving that Ford Explorer that kicks out more CO2? I mean, don't be discouraged. It takes a lot of individual efforts that can add up to something significant. James George, the author, diplomat, and founder of the Threshold Foundation and president of the Sadat Peace Foundation, adds, quote, without such a transformation, all the political and economic reforms, all the technological fixes are mere tinkering at the margins of the problem. So if the task before us is essentially spiritual, How do we become the change we want to see in the world? We begin by reclaiming a sense of awe at the majesty and mystery of creation, that grand design of life and light in which we live and move and have our being. And even as we celebrate our uniqueness, we recognize ourselves as part of something bigger, what might be called our contextual reality of creation. In a very real sense, of course, the issue is less about the environment as it is the nature of religious imagination, which is the last section that I'm going to talk to you about. Religious imagination, that is, our ideas about God, and our ideas about God affect and color our ideas about the sacred. The religious imagination has always sought to express the infinite through the finite, the sacred through earthly symbols. We are, as the book of Hebrews says, a little lower than the angels. As sensual beings, we touch, we smell, we see, we hear. We not only comprehend transcendent reality through our physical senses, but we envision God and define the sacred through the lens of human culture, that sum total of learned behavior that characterizes members of a society. We also tend to see God in human terms, anthropocentrically. In our scriptures, God loves, gets angry, creates, destroys. God even bargains with humans, makes contracts, and bets with the devil. But at the same time, we also believe that God is different than us. There is an otherness about God, a divine being set apart and holy. God is profoundly different from us. God is the Holy One, the great I Am. It is precisely because many of us see God as holy that we try to put God in His place or God in her place. If we are temporal and earthbound, we reason that God must be eternal and heavenly. For example, in Genesis 28th chapter, Jacob dreams of a ladder set up on earth, which reaches to heaven. And on it, the angels are seen ascending and descending from heaven to earth. Our architecture reflects these kinds of imaginings, from the Washington National Cathedral's vaulted Gothic naves and soaring clear-story windows of that brilliant stained glass to the angel Moroni on the Temple Square. Our eyes are drawn heavenward. But as wonderfully evocative as heavenly metaphors and soaring architecture can be, their vision is limited. They define what cannot be defined, a transcendent creator who is omnipotent and omnipresent. What is important to realize is that wherever we find God, we find hallowed ground. This can have important implications for the environment. If heaven is up there and we're down here, can we care, really profoundly care, for the planet, its air, its waters, its rivers, its mountains, plains, and valleys? If we envision this life as a veil of tears, a mere trance stop to the sweet by and by, if we envision this corner of creation on which we dwell as a stockpile of material goods left behind by God for us to use and exploit as we please, if our sense of the sacred is exclusively otherworldly, what is to happen to our world? For too long, God has been confined in the Western religious imagination to the heavenly realms and set apart from creation, even though Hebrew and Christian scriptures are filled with allusions to God's Spirit, which infuses heaven and earth and sustains the cosmos and all things. Might we not share in Jacob's astonishment when he declared after awakening from that sleep, "Surely the Lord was in this place and we did not know it." Jesus, in urging his followers not to swear by heaven or earth, called heaven the throne of God and earth God's footstool. The Quran, Islam's holy book, describes humans as vice regents of Allah, suggesting that we have a role in caring for God's creation. Until recently, the battle to save the environment has been essentially waged by governments, secular environmental organizations, and their contributions remain absolutely essential. But government and environmental activists recognize, as we have already seen, that without a faith-based response to the environmental crisis, that overarching religious ethos of which I spoke, all of the efforts to save the environment through political, economic, and technological means, important as they are, will ultimately fail. I want to close my remarks by reporting that there is good news. Newspaper men are notorious. Newspaper women, too, are notorious for always writing about the bad news. I've got some good news to report. Which is probably why it will never see the day in my newspaper, but so I'm writing a book. Here's the good news, that there is a growing consciousness among a lot of good people about the religious and spiritual connection to preserving the environment. And the best part about it is to making us and bringing us true happiness. It's something that I found just walking through those woods in Callaway County. I'm going to write about this in that book by Island Press, which, of course, I all want you to go out and buy so you have more stuff in your house. But there is a nascent and awakening recognition by faith communities of these links. Delving into the great deposit of religion and spiritual wisdom, there is this dawning that the crisis of the environment is fundamentally a crisis of the spirit. And for people of faith, for seekers of transcendent meaning, to honor and care for creation is to honor the one who created all things. This is not polytheism. This is not paganism of which I speak. We are not worshiping the trees. We are, as the Bible says, worshiping with the trees. It is an act of worship. And this is a new and a very ancient epiphany. Across America and around the world, congregations, individuals, and relatively new organizations of faith-based earth keepers are making choices that are motivated by a profound appreciation for the created order. They are already making a difference in their own lives, and together their actions are beginning to make a difference for the commons. We want to do the right thing. We are good people. We recycle our newspapers and cans. We try to buy energy-efficient light bulbs. We buy water-conserving shower heads. We may join an environmental organization or volunteer for a cleanup of a park, help restore a prairie, a wetland. More and more are doing this not because they are part of a secular environmental group, but because they love God. They are earth keepers. They care for creation. Leading theologians are also coming to grips with our plight. They are delving deeply as well into the faith traditions. Kung, a Roman Catholic theologian, I'm not a Roman Catholic myself, but I seem to be quoting them a lot, said that the evil produced by science and technology cannot simply be healed by even more science and technology. I don't know that I would go as far as he has in describing it all as evil. Obviously, our lives are much better. We have a wonderful standard of living. The question is, have we moved into an extravagant way of living? You know, back in my part of the country, you know, they say it's not living high on the hog, but it's not the high cost of living, but the cost of living high on the hog. And that cost has a spiritual cost as well as an environmental cost. Others are building a framework for action, whether it is the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, the Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life, the Evangelical Environmental Network, and other such groups. By the way, the National Religious Partnership for the Environment is based in New York, and it's composed of Jewish denominations, mainline Protestant denominations, evangelical churches, as well as some Buddhist groups and Hindu groups. I haven't heard whether Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is involved in that. I do not think they are at this point. I want to conclude these remarks by sharing an experience that I had not so very long ago. I had been invited by a group of Jewish, as it happens, environmentalists to one of their retreats in the foothills of Ventura County in California. And on one moonlit night, we gathered in a circle, and we placed our arms over each other's shoulders like this. And in the center of the circle was a young woman with long, flowing hair, and she was our storyteller. And she asked us to do certain things, and now it's night, and there's a cool breeze, and there are clouds in the air, and the moon looks like it's surfing just dreamily from cloud to cloud. She asked us to do some imagining. First, she said, she wanted us to close our eyes and imagine a shaft of light from the heavens penetrating our bodies from our head to our toe, and that shaft of light continuing into the earth. Then she wanted us to imagine another source of light in our heart radiating out through our arms to the persons beside us, like this. This is the feminine sense of spirituality. It's, guys would never think of this. And I'm grateful for it. There is a sensitivity there that is needed. And then she said, as we held each other, and imagine this vertical, this is not the sign of the cross, folks, this vertical and this horizontal light. She asked us to be aware of the moon and the planet in its orbits, the fertile, life-giving earth on which we stood, the gentle breeze that caressed our faces and filled our lungs, the weight of our arms on the shoulders of those next to us. This exercise in mental imagery awakened in us, and certainly in me. It awakened me to the fact that we are connected to all that is, visible and invisible, animate and inanimate, vertical and horizontal. For those brief moments in that cool Californian night, we knew intuitively that our lives are connected to God, to each other, and to all creation, and that we are made of the same stuff as stars. As it is written in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 39, we were acknowledging and taking heart that the Lord is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Set before us is what Father Thomas Berry, whose books and insights have rightly made him a kind of a modern-day shaman. I had the great opportunity of spending an hour with Father Berry about a year ago at Harvard. And he told us then that what lies before us is something that he calls the great work. This great work, he said, is to restore creation as we restore ourselves. We did not ask for this work, but circumstances have thrust it upon us. As you had mentioned earlier, that this weekend, for example, the Earth will have, this very weekend, 6 billion people. It has doubled in 40 years. 40 years ago, there were 3 billion people. There are enough people born every day that on every third day, there are enough people born every 3 days to fill the city of San Francisco, every 3 days. Our generation, therefore, as no other, stands at an environmental and ethical crossroads. We can find a better way to authentic happiness and live in harmony with each other and with the living planet, or we can continue on a path that is now altering, even now altering, the planet's living systems and diminishing the quality of our lives for the sake of our children and others who follow, the planet on which we depend, and all living things. Our choice is clear. Quote, I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses, the writer of Deuteronomy said. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. That's wonderful. I'm going to just offer a few thoughts rather informally, some things I've been thinking about for 15 years, and also things that Larry's paper have made me focus on right now and think a little bit more about. I'm going to do two things. First of all, I'm going to offer just a few niggling little criticisms of the paper to get them out of the way, because I absolutely agree with everything that Larry has said, virtually everything. And then I'm going to talk about a Mormon angle on these topics that Larry has brought up for us. First of all, whatever criticisms I'd have are very minor. First one, I think, you talk about how in the past, or you talk about society now as if we've fallen, as if we've there was a time when we were better at environmental issues, and I'm sure you'd agree with me that that's not the case. It's just that with the population now, environmental issues have become a major issue for us. The other criticism that I would have. And this is not a criticism. This is something that I would stress if I was writing an essay. And I think probably to most people it would seem like you did stress this. I think I would stress a little more community and how we absolutely can't solve, this is my opinion, we absolutely can't solve environmental issues unless we solve issues of social justice. The two are inextricably linked, I believe. And that brings us, though, to spirituality. Spirituality is the whole that unites environmentalism and social justice issues and all the other problems of the world. Spirituality and a lack of it in our modern society is the root of the problems that I see in the world. So those are my minor criticisms. Now for a few thoughts on Mormonism and these issues of environmentalism. First, a personal thing. When I was 14 or so, I started volunteering for the Utah Wilderness Association, an organization that's now defunct. But I was moved by the environment, and I wanted to be involved. What I found in UWA was very few Mormons, it seemed like, or at least practicing Mormons. And I've always had, up until reading Larry's paper and doing a lot more environmental thinking because of this, I've always had the impression that Mormons are bad at environmental issues. And I've changed my mind. I'd call it a great irony of Mormonism and environmentalism. We appear to be bad, I think, but I think that's much more American than it is Mormon. I think we're very American, particularly here in Utah, we're very Western, and the things that we Mormons can see about ourselves and point to as evidence that we're bad on environmental issues, I think, are more Western American issues. I think that we have a great environmental tradition, and that's been kind of surprising to me to think about this and to kind of come to this conclusion. I think you can definitely argue the other side, but I think there's a great case to be made that we are very good at environmental issues and we've got a rich tradition. These are the reasons that I think that. Well, first of all, let me just briefly talk about how I would go about arguing the other side. One, we have a tradition in Mormonism, a scriptural tradition, and a very practiced, lived tradition of separating ourselves from the world. We believe that, well, like Hugh Nibley talks about so much, there's Babylon and there's Zion, and the two don't mix, and you're in one camp or you're in the other. And if you're in the camp of Zion, you remove yourself from the world. To me, that's the theological basis for whatever anti-environmentalism there is in Mormonism. We kind of see this world as a disposable world. We can use it and then move on to the celestial kingdom when we're done. So that's how that's where I think Mormonism's anti-environmentalism stems from. That's the scripture in Moses where the earth mourns for the weight of the sins of humanity and how the Lord cries for the earth. I think that is such a remarkable, beautiful scripture and a great asset that Mormonism has. Mormonism, in my mind, has the strengths of Christianity when it comes to the environment, yet we've got more. I don't want to sound like I'm praising Mormonism too much. I certainly recognize our faults. But our tradition and the potential tradition is remarkable. Larry talked about the old home place and how we all have sacred places. We each do individually, whether it's the old home place, whether it's where we were born, whether it's a favorite place in the mountains. Mormonism, collectively, we as a community have so many sacred places. It's almost as if we have too many. The Mormon Trail, you go from stop to stop to stop to stop, and you read the stories, and everyone is a sacred place in some sense. We have the big sacred places, the temples. We have Nauvoo. We have so many places. We have the sacred places of Christianity. But that is a wonderful thing about Mormonism. Our tradition, Joseph Smith, says that everything in the world is sacred, that there really isn't much of a difference between the sacred and profane. And so I think that is something that we can really use to build a pro-environmental stance on. Let's see. We have an ongoing tradition, though. We don't just have a theoretical tradition that we could build on. We have a very strong ongoing tradition. We have Brigham Young, who whose environmental positions, if you want to call them that, they weren't, certainly weren't, but his positions were that the earth, Utah, state of Deseret, was communal. It belonged to all of us, and it wasn't individual. That is something that, that is a remarkable tradition. And then since then, we have, another prime example is President Kimball talking about not killing the birds. That's become a famous thing amongst us. And we do have that. We have a reverence for life. Often it's a little bit hidden. Again, I'd argue that that's our American West coming through and not our Mormonism. And lately, we have someone that many of you here would know quite well, Larry Young. I'm just citing him as an example. He's back in Washington, D.C. right now, lobbying for SUA, trying to protect the environment in his own way. I'm saying that because I don't necessarily agree with SUA, but I think Larry's a wonderful person. I think he's doing great things. But that's just another example. We do have strong activist people who are very committed to the environment and very interested in it. And so in conclusion, I'd just like to say just one little idea. What if we had a Mormon environmental organization? I think it would be something that could really strengthen the Mormon community and the way we regard the environment. It'd probably be another fringe group, and certainly wouldn't be a panacea, but it could do good things. I guess I'll conclude right there. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And we do have time for comments and questions. That was an extremely moving paper. Thank you. And it's nice to hear Eric so upbeat. And tuned in on the traditions that do exist. I'm going to overstep my role as chairman for just one second because I was trying to think specifically of some Mormon issues connected with the environment, and I came up with a few, and they are not as upbeat as Eric's, but that would not imply for a moment that in our sacred traditions that strain of awe and reverence for all life and for the planet is not there. First of all, I think there is the basic question of the whole Judeo-Christian tradition, which emphasizes man's dominion. Now, this is only one aspect. There's a mirror image to that. There's the good stewardship. But it is an interesting contrast to Buddhism or Native American religions that emphasize connection. And no one is dominant. No life form has the right to feel itself dominant over any other. This challenges us to the very core of our being. None of us believe that. I don't believe in our American and Mormon tradition, in our own individual tradition. Then there's, as Larry has implied, for all Americans there is a very strong LDS alliance, I believe, with the American economic and material tradition, and an implication that more and bigger are better. And I think there is a strong alliance with the whole industrial economic machine. Then there's the mandate in our theology that spirit children urgently need physical bodies. That's that whole question. Can we go on believing that? The urgency of that. Then there is the sending forth of missionaries to proselyte with no regard or little regard for native values and the values of indigenous peoples. That whole area. Then there's the ecliptical and millennial strain that says, what does it matter anyway? It's all going to be over, the end time cannot be deferred nor changed. Then there's our basic anthropomorphism, which Mr. Stamer mentioned, which allows us to ignore the sacralization of other life forms. So I just would suggest those as specific links and challenges to our Mormon theology and practice. Questions and comments, please. Yes. Would you come up?
Sure.
So we can, and I'll either repeat the questions or please come up.
My question relates to some of the comments that Marion was making, and that is, in other countries where they have different religions, such as Buddhism, where there is more of a connection, do they have a better approach to the environment? Is there more environmentalism there? So can you respond to that?
Yes, I can. No, they don't. I mean, you can begin with the they had this expression in Sacramento when I covered the legislature. They said, "Let's elevate this conversation from statesmanship to politics." Begin politically. I mean, if you look at the former Soviet Union, they trashed their whole country. There's all kinds of waste, toxic waste, nuclear waste. They killed a whole sea. And so a secular ethic obviously didn't inform other decisions. It was a very materialistic view. Now, if you look at Japan, Japan's environmental record until recently was not very good, despite the perhaps the influence of Buddhism or Shintoism in Japan. Western Europe is pretty much Christian, at least nominally. So, same with South America. You look at Muslim countries, Indonesia, I mean, for economic reasons, despite the Quranic thought, rainforests are being hit. They're going after the hardwoods, the mahoganies, things like that. So I think everybody has a lot to ask for forgiveness for. I think there's a lot of repentance due. One might say that in the United States that actually we're doing better than some of those other countries. Part of that is a product of our wealth. And it is argued that one cannot protect the environment unless one has the money to do it. This is an argument made by industry. You have to have the wherewithal to do it. One reason that Los Angeles is a lot cleaner than it was when my wife and I moved there 18 years ago is because of the controls, the costly controls imposed upon automobile makers and on stationary sources of pollution. These are all costly things to do. Then you compare Los Angeles, say, to Mexico City, and you see the difference that money makes. What I'm suggesting is that we need to do much more given the magnitude of the threat that stands before maybe not so much us, but our children and our grandchildren and their children. If you look at the growing population, the diminishing resources, the kinds of ways we use energy, much more has to be done. I have several concerns. One is strictly an environmental concern. I worry about the quality of our country, of our city, of our planet. But I worry, too, about just this the consumer culture that we, more than anyone else in the world, here, the acquisition of so many things. I mean, how much does one need to be happy? And the more one accumulates, the greater pressure there is on the natural resources. Even the term natural resources is in some sense pejorative because by using the term natural resources, we're saying, well, these are resources. This is, there's certainly not a kinship there. In response to your statement, Marion, no one is dominant, you said. I'm not sure I disagree. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that. I do think that humans are special. I do think that because of our intelligence, which varies from person to person, you know. But, I mean, so far as we know, we're the only species that thinks. I mean, there's some speculation about dolphins and things like that, and other species do communicate on some level. But we are a little lower than the angels. And so because of that, we have a special responsibility. We can't walk away from that. We have a responsibility to the other creatures, animate living things and things like that. So I guess that would be my response. I don't see that Buddhism or any other faith system has necessarily done it any better. But I do think that we are in a position to do more than we have, and we really don't have a choice. We really do not have a choice if you look at the trends. I mean, I don't like to be totally negative. Because I don't want to discourage people from acting. There is much that we can do, and it doesn't happen. Doesn't have to continue this way. The Ozone Protection Treaty, the Montreal Protocol. I mean, you hear these stories, and they're true, that the ozone hole is getting bigger and bigger. But there are fewer ozone-destroying chemicals going into the atmosphere now, particularly CFCs, because they don't manufacture them anymore. They found substitutes. Now, the substitutes aren't all that good either, but they're better than CFCs. And so over a long period of time, the ozone hole is going to be restored. So this is a long-haul thing, but it's a long-haul thing that involves individual choices made on a daily basis.
There's an old Mormon tradition of opposition in all things, and I guess maybe I fill that role. And it's a little, I really appreciate the tone of what you said. You made one comment, trees cut down in the name of prophets. Or was it trees cut down in the name of progress? The latter. I was reminded of a comment by a journalist who was traveling through Canada on a train and said something like, what a terrible thing to cut down all these beautiful trees for those bloody newspapers. That journalist was Winston Churchill. And I, as a fellow who owns land and cuts down trees, I cut down some trees that may end up in newsprint for the Los Angeles Times. And I kind of took it from what you said, that you didn't like trees cut down in the name of progress. The kind of impertinent question that I'm going to ask, and it goes to all of us that live the way we live, and yet we talk about the damages to the environment. Give me a yes or no answer. Should I and other people who cut down trees to provide newsprint for the Los Angeles Times stop doing this today? Should we stop cutting down trees so the Los Angeles Times does not have newsprint?
I've wanted to give this answer for so long because I've heard it so often when I ask a question. No comment. No, let me be more respectful in my answer. First, I'll share a story. When I was at the San Jose Mercury, which is in Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, years ago, Santa Clara County used to be known as the Valley of Heart's Delight because there were a lot of prune orchards and cherry orchards and apricots and things like that. And they were cutting down all these orchards because they're building subdivisions and freeways are going through and things like that. And someone asked the publisher of the San Jose Mercury, you know, why he didn't do something about this to protect the bucolic atmosphere of the Valley of Heart's Delight. And his response was, trees don't read newspapers, which is a harsh thing to say. I think we're talking about the good use and the best use of our resources and the most efficient use of our resources. I'm not here to defend the Los Angeles Times, even though they pay me, but I think that the figures are that 60 or maybe 70% of the newsprint we use is recycled newsprint. So there are efforts being made. I was thinking when I said that about the land in Missouri, about my land, or the land given to my care for a while. No, I realize that. There's something that, to me, brings about a revulsion, though, when large lumber companies want to cut down ancient redwoods in Humboldt County in order to pay off bonds because they bought the company and wanted to leverage its assets. I think that's sinful. What really bothers me, and my primary concern, is what are we doing? Why are we doing these things? What are we searching for in the material? I mean, I'm a reporter speaking, but you know, I struggle with these faith issues, like I'm sure you guys do. And a lot of what we're doing is hurting not only the planet, but ourselves, because we're looking in the wrong places. That's my main point.
Trees are renewable, actually. I wanted to address the topic you brought up about the spiritual connectedness and the environment. And I'm sure you're familiar with the works of Wendell Berry, and where he, I think, took the Sierra Club to task a little bit for saying, are you just after pretty scenery, or are you after the environment and the world? And one way that man reacts with the environment, or the most familiar way we have, is through agriculture. And I'm not necessarily talking about agribusiness today, but the idea which I think started at the very beginning of the Salt Lake Valley, that we're going to come in here and make Zion, and we're going to plant trees because all there is is sagebrush here, and we're going to divert streams, and we're going to plant our gardens. And that was, if you read the works of Brigham Young, that's what he constantly is talking about, better ways to do this, and this is what our business should be, not going after gold in the hills. What I sense in our suburban culture, or should I say the urbanization this last century, is that we've lost that physical connectedness to the earth and thereby lost the spiritual connection. As you nod, I can see that's not unfamiliar to you. What may be unfamiliar is that the president of the church, Spencer Kimball, in the late 70s, perhaps you could say he was, since Brigham Young, maybe the most environmental prophet we've had. One of his mandates was every garden, and he didn't exempt people that live in condos in downtown, but the idea was worldwide Mormons should be involved in gardening. I haven't heard that mandate emphasized much since the late 70s, but what I see is that was, to us Mormons, that's a prophetic utterance that this is one way we need to keep that connectedness. And I'm thinking of my aunt's place in Mapleton, Utah, my great aunt, and she lived essentially off her garden half the year. And Mapleton, if any of you were there 30 years ago, a wonderful place. And now Mapleton is part of suburbia, and the lawns are so small that I asked my wife, what's missing? The houses are sure nicer here than they used to be, but what's missing are all the poplar trees and the gardens that everybody had in their back lot. Anyway, I just wanted to comment on that and say that I think as a culture, I don't know, again, if that's Mormon or that's American, or we're not going to knock doors in Mapleton and find out who's who, but the idea that perhaps we're losing, that in a few instances which you may be aware of, there are urban garden organizations getting started and finding the same type of results that Spencer Kimball talked about 30 years ago, that when you have that connectedness to the earth, maybe you have that spiritual connectedness as well.
Could I respond to that? Because it brings another question that Eric brought up. You mentioned that Spencer Kimball had urged everyone to plant a garden, and Eric had mentioned the quote from the Book of Moses, the earth mourns for the, what is it? What was the quote? I can't read my own writing now. The earth mourns for the right of the, for the sins of humanity and how the Lord cries for the earth. I don't want to be presumptuous, so I'll just speak about my own tradition. What has to happen is we're pretty much stuck with our scriptures. There are things in Christian and Hebrew scripture that are embarrassing today. Things have changed, times have changed, and yet this is Holy Writ. What do you do with it? You reinterpret it. That's what you do. You look at the Genesis myth, and I use the term not pejoratively. The Genesis myth, as we mentioned, that God created man and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, and he gave man dominion. And another word used in that that myth is to conquer, if I remember, to have dominion over. Those are fighting words. What do you do with it? Well, now I know in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the favorite version of the Bible is the King James Version, which I was told is the version that Jesus read. I only heard that the other day. I love the King James Version. But in the New International Version, which is the preferred translation used by many evangelical churches, and I'm not an evangelical either, there is a footnote at the bottom of the New NIV Study Bible that looks at this Genesis, and it talks very, very clearly about stewardship, and wants to make sure that the readers of these passages, these sacred passages handed down, are understood as they ought to be understood. Now, some people go on to say, well, it was always meant to be that way, and it was us that misinterpreted it over for a period of time, but now we get it. But whatever the case is, there are all kinds of resources in the Holy Scriptures of your church. I've read them, and the Old Testament and the New Testament. The resources are there and available to use, and it seems to me that the faith communities have a wonderful opportunity and an obligation to act and to teach and to instruct. That's I'm preaching here, I know. I'm not here as a journalist today.
I'm saddened when people, good people, feel at odds with one another's efforts to improve the situation of lack of respect for the environment. I believe that every effort by every human being matters, including maybe the seed in the feeling of guilt that somebody may feel at driving an Explorer. I think this is a good and wonderful impulse and should never be diminished because it doesn't do everything that needs to be done. And if a person is moved indeed to cancel their subscription to their newspaper, I respect that too as a means for conservation, even though people are making, big corporations even, are making great efforts to improve things. So all effort should receive our thanks, because indeed it will, every effort will prolong for a few moments the habitability of this planet. So I think we need to be very careful to avoid divisiveness in our approaches to this challenge. If a person who owns land on which trees exist and who feels entitled to use the resources of that land should make even the smallest effort to rejuvenate or replace or manage what is taken. We're all doing that every moment in our lives. We're consuming the energy of the earth. And all we need to do is to think more carefully about giving the earth's due back. This, to me, is real tithing. Yes, giving back in terms of respect, maybe motivated by our respect, and unlimited except by the limits of our imagination. And if a lot of our efforts should even make things worse, that too is okay, because we're very short-sighted and we don't have that cosmic view of what's going on. So I just think everything we say, everything we think, and everything we do matters on this issue, which to me is the most important single issue. It is the spiritual issue, manifested in one way. And since there are two sides to the coin of what is sacred and what's secular, one of them is that everything is sacred, and the other is that everything is not. And somehow when we think of it as not, we think we have the right to exploit it. On the other hand, if we think if everything is sacred, then we are obligated to think in terms of respect.
Candace, would you come up here?
Thanks.
Now, I'm not educated on this subject, but it seems to me throughout history that earth-based spirituality has been connected with a matriarchal religion. And I would argue that the Mormon Church's point of view on the earth is similar to its point of view on giving women spiritual authority. Women are not given spiritual authority, and the earth, which is likened unto women, is, you know, things grow from the earth, things are given birth from the earth. I seriously doubt that the church will give the earth spiritual authority, because it is for its use as opposed to for its used for its ability to create spiritual hierarchy and things like that. I'm wondering what we can do to promote an attitude that would give the earth more authority within the Mormon Church. I don't know. What do you all think?
I'd like to respond to that just briefly. In my response to Larry's paper, as Marian noted, I stressed what to me is the positive aspects of Mormonism. Let me also say, though, I think that we as a culture are a disgrace to the planet. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. I am not optimistic. I'm very pessimistic about the future of about Mormonism's ability to change, like you're talking about. I'm also very pessimistic about the future of humanity on this planet. but I sincerely believe in living with hope and trying to change. And that's what I meant when I concluded with, what if we had a Mormon environmental organization that tried to do something?
Many of this in this room have had their forebears, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents who labored across the plains for what they believe would be their promised land. We have a Jordan River that connects a freshwater lake to a Dead Sea here. We call Brigham Young the American Moses. This was indeed a promised land. It was a promised land not only for Mormons, but for many non-Mormons as well. It's a blessed land, and I've spent a good deal of time roving here. I live in Los Angeles now. But I've wondered, those of you who read the prophet Amos, a very plain-spoken man who had conversations with God. And I've thought in my own mind, if God said, Amos, I want you to go down and take a look at these people who are heirs to the promised land. What are they doing with it? How have they taken care of it? What are their feelings towards it? And then I can visualize Amos coming back, and God says, Amos, what did you find? And Amos runs his toe around in the dust and is reluctant to speak. And God says, Amos, then Amos has to speak. And he said, well, your honor, your grace, your majesty, they're not doing very well. They are not doing very well as a people. And I think here we, you know, we grew up on the notion of that we came here, we made the land blossom like the rose, and now we're paving over the gardens. We are paving over the gardens. We are exhorted to multiply and replenish the earth. The earth, we have multiplied. The earth is replenished. And if you sit for 45 minutes on I-15 and recognize that part of the problem is us, and it's time for us to change. And our dean, I'm sympathetic to your notion. You know, all ideas have some respect. But if we're to change, you know, this brother says that we have the prospect for change is not awfully great. He's pessimistic. I'm kind of pessimistic, too. But if we are to change, then those ideas that we feel are correct and right, they have to be fought for. This room, speaking on this subject, should be full. The relation between the spirit and the environment, that is key, that is critical, that is critical. And I think it's kind of a comment on the nature of our present-day attitudes in this state that this place isn't overflowing. We ought to fill the tabernacle when we talk about the environment. And that's what is striking to me. I hope for better things, but I think if we get better things, we have to get out and fight for them. We have to fight for them. And I look at our legislature up on the hill. I don't think it is a representative legislature of the body of the Mormon people. I think there's more environmental thought among the Mormons than is registered in what is said to be our representative legislature up on the hill, the congregation of megatwits.
Thank you. Everyone's comments have been wonderful, and we'll only have time for about a couple more. So can we have this gentleman, Eric, did you want?
I think
I want to respond, but I can wait. Okay, let's just have this.
I was just going to say, in response to your question about what we might do here, at least in this area, is some kind of highway beautification program. I am originally from Los Angeles, and it tears me up to drive around in Utah, specifically in the Salt Lake area, because I'm so used to some of the freeway areas in Los Angeles or north up towards Ventura, Santa Barbara, where they have tried very hard to beautify the environment. And I'm baffled by why it's so ugly and awful.
Thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you very much, all of you, for your comments. I'm going to remember them, keep them in mind. I wanted to speak to Eric's pessimism. It bothers me a great deal to see pessimism in a young man. Pessimism is for old men. But Eric's being realistic. I understand that. Here's the deal. If, no matter what we do, let's just say for the sake of argument, no matter what we do, it ain't going to make things better. Things are going to keep going on. Ford is going to be building bigger and bigger cars, the Explorer and then the Expedition, and they're coming out with something else even bigger. And I don't mean to pick on Ford, because I've bought Fords in my lifetime. And my daughter and son-in-law drive a Ford Explorer. Even if we say it's not going to work, here comes the spiritual side of it. And it seems to me that Latter-day Saints know better than most other people of faith what it means to stick to your guns and persevere in the face of all kinds of challenges and persecution. The Jews do too. You do it not because you're necessarily going to win the environmental battle. You do it because it's the right thing to do. You do it because it's an act of worship. You do it because it's in response to God's love. And you do that whether you win or lose. But I think if we do it that way, I think if people had that attitude, that there might be grounds for a little more optimism. That's just a closing thought that I had.
One more, anyone? Yes.
This comment has sort of been addressed already, but it's looking more at what we can do and how do we go forward. You mentioned that there's not much difference in the behavior of those who are in a faith community versus those who are not. And along with that, has this, what in your experience, in your investigation, has caused you to change your behavior? And so along with that, what can we do? Is it perhaps changing the way we refer to scriptures? Let's start talking about honor and worship and value and God as a part of creation, and that that is a holy act, that wherever God is, that is sacred ground, emphasis on ground. In my study, I have come to feel, partly I've felt it for a long time, mountains are holy places. And it, because that's a feeling that I get when I'm there, but also in study of the Old Testament, that is a place where altars were built. That is actually a holy place to the Lord. So if that is a holy place, isn't it our obligation to protect it? So can we then, part of an answer to my own question, is it possible to change the way we, all of us, actually talk about environmental issues by avoiding those controversial phrases? I have heard people really get upset calling it an environmentalist. Is a real nasty word. But talking about it in a scriptural base, as an honor, as a worship, is that a possibility? Do you have other suggestions?
I think you've answered your own question, but I will tell you that one good resource, there are hundreds and hundreds of congregations of different faith groups across the country that are actively doing things. Some are retrofitting their churches with energy-efficient lights. It's not only good for the environment, it's handy on the budget. There are all kinds of practical things. If you were to get in touch with the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, they have all kinds of resources available. The names of other congregational groups. They have a website, by the way, the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. And there are hundreds of groups in most of the states, maybe all 50, I don't know. I haven't checked lately, that are doing things. They get involved in beautifying a local park or a waterway or cleaning up something. But the point of it all is that all of that fosters a growing consciousness about caring for creation, and it is motivated by faith
and not by membership in the Sierra Club or the Wildlife Society, as good as organizations as I'm sure they are. So there are things that can be done and are being done. And so if you just look them up on the webpage, they're there. And I've got wonderful resources. Paul Gorman is leading that, and he's done a fine, fine job.
Thank you all very much. And perhaps we can, in fact, establish a Mormon environmental organization. Who knows? Thank you.